is a work that is on epic scale, but it's not an epic. It's an adventure story. Jason and his Argonauts go off in search of the Golden Fleece. It's a mythical story. It's an adventure story. It's quite an engaging tale. It's not very long. It's easy to read. It's great fun. It's a cunning story. It's a clever story. We're presented in it with a number of anomalies. There is a great love interest in the story, Jason and Medea. It's also the case that Jason is a sort of a big, strong, brash, spontaneous kind of fellow who forever is getting himself in trouble. And it's Medea who always is getting him out of trouble and is always figuring out exactly how to prevail in his quest for the Golden Fleece. Now, that's in a way the old brains and brawn issue that we've seen in the Greek world before, but now the woman has the brains and the man has merely the brawn. Perhaps it's always so. Now, it's a story on epic scale. I mean, there are monsters and ships travel long distances and amazing things happen. But in a classic epic, you'd have had verse, not prose. This is a prose work. You wouldn't have had a love story told. It wouldn't have been told in sort of common and ordinary language. And there's nothing universalizing about this story. This is entertainment. This was pleasant diversion. You're not supposed to put the Argonautica down and feel that you have grown morally or ethically. You've been entertained. Menander, who lives from perhaps 342 or thereabouts to 293, maybe as late as 289 BC, is the great writer of comedies in the Hellenistic world, or at least the one whose name we know best. We have a problem here. One of his plays survives completely, one alone. We know the names, again, remember as with the Greek tragedians, we know the names of a number of other plays. We even have fragments of a few of them. But what we have is one play in toto. It's called The Curmudgeon. It's a story about an angry old man. And it is very funny. And it's full of sort of improbably funny circumstances. But again, it is full of ordinary domestic concerns. It's full of daily life. This is, in a way, I Love Lucy. This is the sitcom. This is the remote ancestor of the situation comedy. This is not high comedy, like Aristophanes, where humor, perhaps even ridicule, certainly satire, is used to poke fun at, to make comments about great events of the day. Menander is just funny. You read him, you learn, oh, maybe there is a kind of a point. I mean, good heavens, every time we watch a sitcom, there is a point, I suppose, of some kind in them. But they're pretty simple. They're pretty homely. They're not the kind of thing that are ever going to be carved in stone and put on the front of a building. All right? So we also begin to see entertainment as escape. And that'll take us to the philosophies of the Hellenistic world. The two great ones, of course, were Stoicism and Epicureanism. Philosophies that specialists in these areas have called therapeutic. Therapeutic because they were philosophies designed to make you feel better. They were philosophies for people who lived in a world whose values and institutions seemed somehow to have failed. Things seemed to have gone desperately wrong. The polis was gone. The world of the citizen was gone. Vast empires had arisen. Impersonal government had arisen. From all accounts in the literature of the time, alienation was common. And the focus began, therefore, for philosophical writers to shift to ethics. How can I cope with this world? How can I live? That somehow now seemed a lot more important than what is the world made of? What are the grand principles that underlie everything? Now, I don't want to imply that no one was thinking about those questions, but fundamentally, thought was moving in slightly different directions. So, the most famous, then, of these philosophies, Stoicism and Epicureanism. Let's begin with a few words about Stoicism. Stoicism takes its rise with Zeno. Zeno lived in Athens, 335 to 263 BC. He taught, more or less in the open, at the Stoa Poikile, the painted porch, near the Athenian Agora in Athens. So, funnily enough, we ought really to speak of Zenoism or something like that, but we talk of Stoicism, which literally means porchism. Odd word, that. He falls very much in the tradition of Plato and Aristotle. He believes that knowledge is possible. He absolutely believes that. He believes there are things we can know. He believes it's necessary to equate knowledge with virtue. Now, you'll recall, perhaps, that Plato and Aristotle had both said the same thing, that knowledge could be equated with virtue. Zeno believed that there was a kind of a divine reason that permeated all creation, that lay behind everything, that there was a point, a purpose, a law. Think for just a moment of Pythagoras and his theorem, discovering, in a sense, one law that appears to operate in all of nature. Well, by extension, that kind of thinking suggests that there are laws finally behind everything. Virtue consists, therefore, in becoming acquainted with this divine reason, putting oneself into harmony with its laws and with its rules, accepting these propositions as necessary and benevolent. Stoics very often use the image of the theater. We should know our roles and play our roles. We should accept the roles that are assigned to us, but we should learn them very well. This was also a way of thinking that over time would give rise to what we think of as natural law. When Thomas Jefferson speaks of the laws of nature and of nature's God, he is speaking in a way that a Stoic would have spoken about these laws that exist in the nature. We hold certain truths, he said, to be self-evident. They are writ into the universe. They don't exist because a legislature made them or a king made them or somebody wrote a book about them. One has then a moral duty to learn the laws of nature and to live in accord with them. To do so would bring happiness. If I understood how the universe worked and I behaved as if I understood that, I would be happy. Were I happy, I would not be distressed. You see the therapeutic dimension? Pain or stress that exists in any individual, that exists in any society, are a result of misunderstanding, of not possessing knowledge. But pain and distress themselves are not final and not destructive. Even death, you see, is natural, not to